And now, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A24-1015 in the matter of the civil commitment of Michael Andrew Says.
Okay. Now, counsel, as you probably know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument and an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. There is a clock in the upper left-hand corner of your screen if you are in gallery mode. Can you both see that? Okay, I see you both shaking your heads. Yes, that'll reset according to the time that you have for your argument. And I just want to ask you to please each introduce yourselves at the beginning of your argument along with your party. That'll help us make sure we're pronouncing everything correctly and understand any requests for pronouns. And additionally, please mute yourself when you're not speaking, but leave your video on. And if either of you has any issues with the technology at any point, please let me know. And we'll do our best to address that. We can take a moment to do that. We want to make sure that we hear from everyone here today. So with that, there are 15 minutes on the clock. And Mr. Winkler, you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Winkler. I prefer male pronouns, and I represent Mr. Michael Says in this matter. And may it please the court. Appellant Michael Says is burdened with a mental illness. We're not arguing that point. He happens to be fortunate that his mental illness is very treatable with neuroleptic medications. That has become a burden of sorts in this case, as well as after his MIND commitment was affirmed by the district court, an updated Rule 20.01 report in his criminal matter deemed that he was returned to capacity. He was discharged from the hospital, taken to the Nicollet County Jail, where he remains today. We provided three arguments for the court that I would like to explore here. First is the substantial likelihood that Mr. Says would engage in serious physical harm or the likelihood of future danger. This court reviews de novo whether there is clear and convincing evidence in the record to support the district court's conclusions. And I would ask this court to focus particularly on the Ferrer factors, which I believe demonstrates the real shortcomings of the state's case in this matter. The first being whether Mr. Says has insight into his mental illness. Testimony that was taken at the 60-day review hearing from his treating clinician demonstrated that he did have insight and was developing growing insight into his mental illness, in that he could speak to his mental illness, define it, know the symptoms associated with it. Further, a second factor is his ability to control his behavior. Again, there was extensive testimony about how he was on a low security unit while at St. Luke's, how he had demonstrated his ability over a prolonged period to control his behavior for the months he was detained on that unit in St. Luke's. And finally, regarding the final factor being whether the appellant in this case was medication compliant. There hadn't been a Jarvis order requiring medication for Mr. Says since 2017. Not only was he compliant with medications, he actually made recommendations regarding what medications would work best to his treating clinician. Those recommendations were adopted. And again, following the incorporation of those medications, Mr. Says demonstrated a long period of stability through the duration of this process.
Mr. Winkler?
Yes, Your Honor.
If I could stop you for a second, I want to make a couple comments. One is both you and the state reference the Ferrer case, but that's a non-precedential case. So that case is not binding on us. And while it certainly can be persuasive and we can look at those factors, we're not required to look at any or all of those factors. And a second comment I have is that Our standard of review is we view the evidence in the light most favorable to the district court's decision, and we analyze whether or not the record supports its decision by clear and convincing evidence. And it sounds to me like you're asking us to reweigh the evidence, which we cannot do. So I think the question is, where does the record not support the district court's decision, given that the district court found three doctors who testified as to him being dangerous? And why doesn't that testimony support the district court's decision with clear and convincing evidence?
Thank you for those questions. First, I note that Ferrer is not precedential. I would note that I did not cite to it in my brief either. However, I found it in preparing for oral argument today. I appreciated how the court in that case laid out what I believe are really crucial factors for this panel to consider. I am not asking the court to reweigh evidence, as indicated. It's not permitted. I suppose that sort of segues into my second argument, which is the sufficiency of the findings here and whether these findings permit actual evaluation of the court's review of the evidence and the findings, given that in the first hearing, the initial commitment hearing, the district court adopted both examiners' reports and testimony in toto without any further description or guidance or information as to what was most significant, way what the court essentially based its decision on. And then more concerning to me, the second order following the review hearing, in which the court does provide an outline of the testimony as provided, but again, adopts the examiner's report and testimony in toto, and also does not provide any information whatsoever as to the court's feelings about Mr. Says' clinician and that testimony. And that creates a gigantic hole here in this matter, because we have a very differing opinion from a clinician who is providing daily treatment, having daily contact with my client, explaining his progression through that treatment process, where the court found him on that day of that hearing. And again, in her role, Ms. Sanawa, I believe is how she pronounced it, role in Mr. Says' case plan, specifically working towards finding him an appropriate discharge in the community, a task that she had, I believe, 14 years of experience in doing, and her belief that discharge to an ERTS facility was appropriate in this case under an MI commitment.
I did want to ask, in terms of Ms. Sanawa's testimony, I mean, wouldn't we read the district court's ruling here then to impliedly or implicitly find Ms. Sanawa's opinion less credible? Or, I mean, I think that still goes to the weighing of the evidence. If you have, you know, three witnesses that are presenting one view and you have Ms. Sanawa presenting a different view, although there wasn't explicitly a statement in the findings of fact saying we do not find or I do not find Ms. Sanawa credible in this regard, that's implicit in the fact that it still decided to make a finding that he was dangerous.
I think that is a fair interpretation of this court's order. However, in my evaluation of it, first, it turns Spicer and subsequent case law on its head in that it asks the court to examine the conclusions and then from the conclusions deduce what the court must have thought about the witness's testimony. In this case, if the district court is siding with the examiner versus the clinician, as made clear in its conclusion and order, then the court must go back and deduce, well, there's the court must have discredited the or not found the clinician credible. Again, that seems to be a backwards approach for appellate review, at least compared to the case law. Again, it also plays into what I note in this court's order as a very binary zero sum approach that this district court undertook, in that examiners are wholly credible, the reports are entirely credible, even if there is conflicting information within those reports. And notably from the first hearing, where one examiner has confused the identity of the other examiner with the clinician, and yet that testimony is deemed by the district court to be as credible as the other examiner. So the approach of the district court to have this, we're finding these examiners entirely credible, and we're going to leave it to this panel to deduce that the clinician is entirely incredible, not credible, again, seems to fly in the face of the case law in this order. And again, leaves a lot of meat on the bone here. We're getting no detail whatsoever as to what the district court found particularly credible in the examiners that, again, was not present in the clinician's testimony. And really, we need more information, in my opinion, in order to deduce what exactly was in the examiner's reports that the district court found compelling versus the clinician. Ultimately, counsel, and perhaps obviously, this is a decision for the district court. The statute does not require that that Mr. Says provide his own forensic examiner that would produce an opinion that an MI commitment is appropriate. So we have these.
Mr. Winkler?
Yes.
If I could, sorry again, if I could pause you for a second. I had a comment and then a comment or a question. In terms of the fairer factors, I just want to go back to that because actually, quite frankly, the question I had for you was the question I was going to have for the county, because I do acknowledge that the county is the one, in fact, that cited to that case and relied on that case and that analysis. And that wasn't something that you had mentioned in your brief. That being said, I do, for my part, I do appreciate your comment that you did find that helpful in terms of that analysis. So thank you for that comment. In terms of the clinician Sanoa's testimony, I would note that the district court did find the three doctors' testimony with respect to appellant's danger to the community to be credible, and that there was not a less restrictive alternative to commitment with respect to that factor. The district court again found their testimony to be credible. But when I listen to your argument, it sounds like you're stating that her testimony, Ms. Sanoa's testimony, relates to the less restrictive alternative. In other words, that he should have been released. But when I look at her testimony, she specifically says that she cannot speak as to whether appellant decompensates when he discontinues his medication, because she never follows up with the patients after they have been discharged. So it seems to me that the district court didn't have to make a credibility determination because her testimony was not relevant as to whether or not a less restrictive alternative to commitment existed, because she doesn't. That's not her role, and she couldn't testify to that.
I would note that on all of the on all of Ms. Sanoa's treatment notes, I believe your encapsulation of the testimony is correct. However, I suppose it's a question of what questions in testimony Ms. Sanoa was asked specifically. I would note that in all of the treatment records, or the bulk of the treatment records that Ms. Sanoa produced, she notes in those records that Mr. Says has a history of commitment. He has a history of Jarvis orders, which show a history of medication non-compliance. He has a history of starting fires on multiple occasions, noting the potential for dangerousness in the community. So while her testimony, while the testimony elicited, I think, could produce the conclusion that you raise here, I would note that the record in its entirety, I think, demonstrates that Ms. Sanoa had that enough familiarity with the patient, Mr. Says, where she could reach those conclusions despite the specificity of what she said in testimony. I hope that was an answer to your question. I don't think I spoke specifically about that less, well, maybe I didn't speak on the less restrictive alternative to commitment. I think it's come through the discussion we've had today anyway, but we had a clinician with months of experience with this particular patient who was comfortable in making a decision regarding that less restrictive alternative. And right now, Mr. Says is on a waiting list and receiving no treatment at all. That's perhaps neither here nor there, but certainly a consideration when we're considering a less restrictive alternative. And I see my time is out, so I will thank you for this opportunity today.
Thank you, Mr. Winkler, and you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal following opposing counsel. And now, Mr. Jarvis, I see there are 15 minutes on the clock. And And just remember to introduce yourself and your client at the beginning. You may begin when you are ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian Jarvis, Assistant Nicollet County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, Nicollet County Health and Human Services, in this matter. To begin, Your Honor, I would wish to address appellants, or rather, Judge Wheelock, your comment about the implied rejection of Ms. Sanoa's testimony by the district court. The county agrees that the district court did impliedly reject Ms. Sanoa's testimony in its second order from May 2nd. Not only by virtue of the fact that the district court did not make that same finding it did for Dr. Sigurdsson, where in finding of fact 16, it found that Dr. Sigurdsson's testimony was persuasive and credible and declined to make such a finding. But beyond that, the district court addressed Ms. Sanoa's testimony in its further findings of fact, such as in finding of fact 24. That finding addressed the less restrictive alternative to commitment, and in that finding, the district court explicitly states that an ERTS facility is not an appropriate placement for appellant in this situation, and states that it's because appellant needs a long-term structured supervised setting. Ms. Sano, the court does recite or summarize some of Ms. Sano's testimony, including that she believed an ERTS facility was appropriate. So both by virtue of the district court declining to make that credibility determination regarding her testimony, and by its own finding, effectively rejecting the testimony the district court summarized in its earlier findings, the district court did strongly imply that it rejected Ms. Sanoa's testimony and instead adopted Dr. Sigurdsson's testimony as the facts it was basing its decision upon. Next, I would also like to address appellant's comment that if this district court were to affirm the district, or sorry, if this court were to affirm the district court's order, that it would effectively turn the Spicer decision on its head. The civil commitment of Spicer case, in that case, this court stated that to permit effective appellate review, a district court's order has to identify the facts it has determined to be true and on which the district court is basing its decision. And in reviewing the orders, looking in particular at the May 2nd order that was the primary subject of this appeal, the district court's order absolutely does that, Your Honors. As noted, the district court makes a credibility determination as to Ms. Sanoa and as to Dr. Sigurdsson's testimony and report. And the district court makes it clear through its findings of fact what it is basing its decision upon.
So, Mr. Jarvis, I actually think this is the bigger concern, at least from my perspective, putting Ms. Sinoa's testimony aside, is, to use Mr. Winkler's words, he said that there was a binary zero-sum approach, that the expert reports are credible. And I did note that finding 16 specifically says that the court finds Dr. Sigurdsson's testimony and 60-day review report were credible and persuasive. The other findings, however, appear to simply be a regurgitation of the testimony that Dr. Sigurdsson provided. And so can you, can you speak to what is enough to show us, what is enough in this order to show us, point to us to the places here where we can see that there wasn't just a acceptance of the testimony, but also sort of consideration of its validity and analysis. I want to be able to find that there.
Certainly, Your Honor. And the county agrees that in the findings leading up through finding of fact 16, as well as I believe a couple after that, when the court also summarizes some of Ms. Sainoa's testimony, that many of those findings, such as in finding of fact 7, 13, and 14, are recitations or summarizations of Dr. Sigurdsson's report and testimony. However, the district court's findings in 21 through 25 effectively either reference and adopt those earlier findings as the facts for its case or address that earlier testimony. I mentioned earlier that finding of fact 24 effectively addresses Ms. Sainoa's testimony, and the district court doesn't just recite that there's no less restrictive alternative. It explicitly makes a finding that a less restrictive alternative facility, such as an ERTS, is not available and explains that it wouldn't be available because appellant needs that long-term structured supervised facility because a short-term facility won't meet his needs and there's a risk of him running away. Additionally, if you look at finding of fact 22, in addressing the clear danger to the safety of others, statutory criteria, in addressing specifically the overt act requirement in that finding, it references the aforementioned overt acts, which are detailed in the summarization in finding of fact 13. And those findings of fact in finding of fact 13 are quite detailed, going into factors like what the overt acts were, when they took place, what county, and as far as the two most recent arson charges, also describing what those arson charges were and against whom. Specifically, in the case of the second arson from 2021 in Wilmer, being against his neighbor for setting his truck on fire, and the most recent one in Nicollet County in 2023 for setting his parents' house on fire. So the district court's findings initially do contain that sort of recitation or summarization of the expert's testimony or the witness testimony, but the district court ultimately brings it all together and references and incorporates that in its final findings in 21 through 25. Therefore, there is an adequate basis for this court to review the commitment order.
Mr. Jarvis, can I ask you a little, perhaps a little more nuanced question about the orders? And I use the word plural, and you referenced the May order. I do feel like that upon my reading, I learned more and more, not only about the judge's credibility findings, but some of those facts and why the less restrictive wasn't available as I read each successive order. It struck me that the first order, however, was the most summary, conclusive, bare bones, you might say, order. And I guess my question is, as a matter of appellate review, do you believe that somehow subsequent orders can heal the inadequacies, perhaps in findings of the first order, which leads to a 60-day review? Because I assume, but for the first order, you wouldn't, I mean, the court arguably, if we felt that was inadequate, it would still be a reversal, even though subsequent orders may have provided more detailed credibility explanation. Could you respond to that, please?
Certainly, Your Honor. While I don't have any case law, because I believe this is a rather novel argument I would make here, the county's position is that under the MIND statute, as well as just practically with how this matter is carried out, that these two orders, the initial order and the second order, are functionally two parts of a whole or two halves of one complete order, in the sense that you never can get from the first order to the second order without that first order, effectively. Additionally, in many ways, that first order, in this case, the one from the January hearing, is almost more akin to a temporary order because by statute, that 60-day review hearing must happen and an order issued following it. And if the district court ultimately decides, based on the examiner and other evidence presented at that 60-day review hearing, that the respondent does not meet the criteria for MIND, they can instead commit that person as just being mentally ill, a less restrictive commitment in that situation. So in a way, the 60-day review hearing order is the more final of the two orders, which certainly seems to line up with the fact that it is also the primary order that is the basis for the appeal here. So it would be the county's position that, well, first, it is the county's position that the January order, admittedly, while it is more bare bones, as you put it, Your Honor, the county does feel there are certain distinguishing factors that do make it still sufficient for appellate review. But if this court does not agree with that, but does agree that the May 2nd order is sufficient to permit appellate review, the county is of the position that the May 2nd order is the one that would control here, and therefore that remand is not warranted. Before I move on, are there any other questions regarding that, Your Honors? To address appellant's arguments regarding the adequacy of, or sorry, rather, whether the district court clearly erred in finding the statutory criteria were met, Judge Reyes, you are absolutely correct that the standard of review here is for clear error. It is not a de novo review, and therefore, this court's standard of review is to determine whether or not there is evidence in the record to confirm or reasonably support the district court's decision. And under that standard, the district court did not clearly err in finding that there was the statutory criteria for civil commitment were met. Specifically, to address first the future dangerous conduct piece, the state did cite to Farrar, and the state agrees it is a unpublished, therefore not precedential and not binding case. However, the state cited to it because it was so factually similar and on point that the state found it to be highly persuasive in this case. Specifically because it involved a similar situation of a mentally ill and dangerous patient who had gone to a facility, completed treatment, and had in that structured facility had started to improve, and yet was still committed as mentally ill and dangerous based upon the testimony of three experts who were in agreement that this person still met the criteria. And the state found that to be very persuasive in conjunction with the three factors that the court so kindly laid out in very clear terms. And under the clear error standard of review, it's the county's position that all three of those factors had adequate evidence to support the district court's determination. As to the past dangerous behavior, the first factor this court highlighted in Farrar, the district court received into evidence the four criminal complaints detailing the three different arsons, as well as the fifth degree assault, and heard testimony from all three of the court examiners that these were overt, dangerous acts that threatened the safety of others. As to the insight into mental illness, again, all three examiners were consistent in their testimony that all of them were in agreement. He lacked insight into his mental illness. Appellant made statements that he did not believe he had a mental illness. He acknowledged that he understood what a mental illness was, but he did not believe that he had one or that he needed treatment to address it. And this court has stated that the medication noncompliance in the Farrar decision is the most important factor. And the district court heard evidence from all the examiners in their reports that appellant has a long history, 14 years of being placed into different civil commitments as mentally ill or in less restrictive settings like an ERTS facility. And as Dr. Oda Pollack put it in his testimony, appellant's behavior is like clockwork. He will go into these structured settings, and because of the supervision in the structure, like with the patient in Farrar, he becomes medication compliant, he starts to improve, but the minute the commitment ends, he is discharged from the facility or leaves, he stops taking his medications, he decompensates, he starts abusing substances like alcohol or illegal drugs, and he engages in overt dangerous acts. Based upon all of that, the district court had substantial evidence to support its decision that he met that criteria the future dangerous conduct prong. And similarly, the district court had ample evidence to support that there was no less restrictive alternative to commitment that could meet the appellant's treatment needs or the public safety concerns. Again, all three examiners opined that appellant needed a long-term, secure, structured setting because appellant has in the past run away from non-secure settings and eloped from those, and that Dr. Reitman explicitly testified that he needed, that appellant needed the intensity of a long-term MIND commitment, that a short-term, for example, regular civil commitment as a person who poses a risk of harm due to mental illness would not be adequate to meet his needs. Dr. Otapalik did not think that appellant would even participate in his treatment if it was not in a structured or supervised setting. And Dr. Sigurdsson testified that appellant, based on his history, has gone through all of these less restrictive alternatives, and they have not been successful in addressing his mental illness symptoms. Therefore, an MIND is the least restrictive alternative to commitment in this situation, or rather that there is no less restrictive alternative to commitment in this situation. So there was absolutely ample evidence to support the district court's finding that the appellant met the statutory criteria, and the district court did not clearly err in finding that the criteria for commitment as mentally ill and dangerous were met. If there are no more questions, based upon all the argument here, the county would ask that this court hold that the commitment orders are adequate to permit effective appellate review, and that the district court did not clearly err in finding that the statutory criteria for committing appellant as mentally ill and dangerous were satisfied. Therefore, the county would humbly ask this court affirm the district court's order.
Mr. Jarvis, I just wanted to ask a question that's not directly related to the appeal, but it obviously was bothering the judge, and Mr. Winkler referenced it too, that he's still being held in jail. Do you have any information on the timeline or expectation or why, that he could actually start receiving treatment?
Your Honor, I know that our organization and the hospital had a meeting yesterday to see about moving Mr. Sayes up to the top of the list. From my understanding and in talking with also the Attorney General's office, the primary issue is just one of resources. Everyone agrees that Mr. Sayes needs to go to the forensic hospital, that he needs those types of services and that type of placement, but it's just a question of whether there aren't enough beds. And I know I'm out of time, but if I can maybe just make one more statement. My understanding is that if a person like him is in jail, it basically is kind of like being put in the fast pass lane. But unfortunately, every county puts these people in the fast pass lane, so it ends up still creating a line in the end anyway. So that's my understanding of the situation at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Jarvis. So we will add 5 minutes to the clock. And once that's on, we will turn back to Mr. Winkler for rebuttal. Mr. Winkler, you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I would just comment again, not specifically related to this matter, but there was testimony taken and comment provided in the record about estimations as to when Mr. Sayes would be moved to the security hospital that ranged from 2 years from the social worker at St. Luke's to 9 months to 1 year from the county attorney. And again, because of Mr. Sayes' disposition at the time of the review hearing, the 60-day hearing, he was deemed a low priority, hence part of that wait list. I would like to turn back to Judge Slider's question and Mr. Jarvis's response regarding how we treat a first order and a second order. And I find Mr. Jarvis's explanation troublesome in the notion that if we're going to have a first and commitment order, order committing a person indefinitely, that does not adequately spell out the nature of the testimony, the reporting, et cetera, that led the court to determine that indefinite commitment was appropriate. The potential for post hoc reasoning, for making a determination that, well, it was unclear why the court found it appropriate to commit him in the first place. So it's much easier to satisfy at a review hearing or a second hearing that the appellant or the the respondent has not demonstrated that commitment still is not appropriate. In other words, I think it's very important that the rationale for the court to determine that indefinite commitment is appropriate is very specifically laid out at that initial state, and that we're not relying on a review hearing and a second order to basically fill in the gaps from that initial order. So if that was the court's intention with these two orders, I think that approach is very problematic and wholly wrong. And I think that based on what I would say are the more obvious inadequacies of the first order, this court should reverse and remand in order to resolve that first order. Again, I appreciate Mr. Jarvis's thorough explanation as to the outlay and purpose of particularly the latter findings in shoring up what is a recitation of the initial findings. But again, I still do not find that credible, and still find it very hard to accept that we are to infer that Mr. Says treatment provider's testimony was not persuasive in any way or provided any explanation as to exactly how it is.
Mr. Wickler, you noted the January order refers to an initial hearing, and then you have, but I think actually the district court acknowledged the difference between the two. In its findings of fact in the May order, it refers to the preliminary procedures and hearing procedures set forth under the Judicial Commitment Act. Right. And then even notes that after a final commitment hearing that occurred, you know, here are the additional findings. So it does seem as if that January order, while not as detailed as the May order, is part of the preliminary procedures and hearings versus the May order, which is occurs after the final commitment, after the 60 days, a final commitment hearing. So it does seem like that the two do go hand in hand and that we can look at both of them in tandem. Why is that not correct?
I think you can look at the orders in tandem. What I'm arguing is that the nature of the findings in the January order in finding that everything the examiners wrote and said without any specific detail, basically accepting it in toto, that can be corrected by a latter explanation in a subsequent order. I think the court can look at the orders together. I just still don't believe that the court can provide insufficient findings in an initial order and then correct it with that second order. That would be the distinction I would make. And once again, my time is up. Thank you once again for your time and consideration in this matter.
I needed to unmute. Thank you, Mr. Winkler. And with that, that concludes oral argument on our final case here. I want to thank counsel for both parties and for the briefing and the argument here today. It was very helpful. And the matter is submitted and we'll take it under advisement. The opinion will be issued within the statutory timeframe. So that ends. Thank you. That ends this morning's calendar, and the court is in recess.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.